BCFM, community radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Starlet Radio Show. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and also to our listeners in Preston and those all over the world, including our new audience in South America. Our guest in this week's studio, is Mohammed El Haddad, who will talk about the recent trip to Gaza. We have another instalment of the Diana interview, and the last of the South American interviews features the Pisco earthquake near Lima in Peru. Malcolm Grease reads another chapter of the history of the Mafia, and we have a wealth of local talent in tonight's show, including our regular weekly performer, Rachel Evanson, who's back with her guitar and a new song. And Jess Box rounds up the show with this latest What's On. I'm John Peters Coleman.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Now in the studio, we have Mohammed El Haddad, who eagle-eared listeners, if such a thing exists, will have spotted it has been mentioned on previous weeks. He's the head of the UK Arabic Society, and he joined the recent Gaza convoy, which is supported and co-organised by Viva Palestina, amongst others, and the UK Arabic Society, to get aid to Gaza in Palestine. And the convoy was sent off from Bristol not so long ago, just over 35 days ago. And they went to London where they had a big send-off, and they've been travelling through the EU, into Morocco and across the Arabic countries all along the coast of North Africa, and they successfully reached Gaza. And I have Mohammed Haddad, who's one of the drivers in the studio, with me now. Hello.
Hi.
So you are back, you're alive, you made
it. Yes, I am.
Excellent, good stuff.
35 days long.
Okay, how pleased were your wife and children? What was the reaction when you came back?
Oh, absolutely warmed. Everything is fine. And, you know, if we've managed to deliver the aid. That was the initial mission we met. And the journey will start now. It hasn't finished. We're going to start now.
Yeah. How much, what was it like when you left London? What sort of a send-off did you have?
I had the greatest send-off from Bristol, not from London.
Yeah.
Have you noticed?
I did know there was a send-off from Bristol.
Yeah, it was in St. Mark's Road in Easton. That was a Friday, 13th of February. Okay. I left from there. There were, a big number of people there to say bye and, you know, have a safe trip to me. And, you know, we had a safe trip.
Mm. Okay. How did you have any problems trying to get through the EU at all? I imagine on the trip to Gaza, I mean, imagining most of the drama is probably going to be through the North African countries.
Yes, we left basically London on 14th, about midday, 14th of February, from the Hyde Park to Ramsgate and then to Belgium, France, Spain, then Morocco, Algeria, okay. Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Rafah, then to Gaza.
Okay.
And I had to go back to Egypt, then to Libya to see my parents over there in Libya. From Libya, I came to London just last week, last Wednesday.
Okay. How many of you left London in Hyde Park? What was
the number of people was about 250 something.
Okay.
And the vehicles were over 110.
Did you have a lot of press attention there at the send-off in London?
Unfortunately, not.
Okay. Were you hoping for more
in the future?
In the future, okay.
Let's cross fingers.
But you've always got us.
Absolutely. I was always in touch with Tony. Your station was probably the only station followed me all the way along to Gaza and back to England.
Okay.
And I'm pleased to say thank you to everybody here.
Okay. I'm surprised you didn't get a little bit more attention, really. What with you had George Galloway who came on the trip with you. Were there any other notable names?
We had Yvonne Radley. She was a very good influence personality lady. She's from the Breast TV. She's been a resident Taliban a while ago, and she converted to Islam. She got married from an Arabic, husband, and she has been with us for the whole, journey from day one to until we arrived back to England. She was also down with us into the floor. She went all the way long. She slept wherever we do. She ate in whatever we ate. And not only one lady, we got about 20 women with us. Five vehicles were driven by women, okay. Women alone. And one of them was only one lady all the way long.
I imagine a woman driving a vehicle through Islamic countries could be... in some places,
she wasn't alone. She was with the convoy all the way long. Okay. Apparently, we lost two vehicles in Tunisia, and I'll talk about this, experience later on.
Okay, what was it like going from Spain into Morocco?
From Spain to Morocco, yes, that was a very good experience. But before that, let me tell you about our experience in the EU.
Okay,
no one knows about us.
Right,
we were just driven on the roads.
Okay, so you had no...
No chance to contact anyone, apart from in Spain. Just one, contact we did with the public. And that was a very good hospitality from Spanish people. They offered us a reception, and we slept overnight in a club, in a social club, something like this.
Okay.
That was a very good reception, and we appreciated that. That was the only contact we made within the EU countries. Then to Morocco, and that was the new experience to us when we crossed to the Arabic countries.
Right.
We had, we did not really expected what happened there. We were heavily investigated by the police, escorts, the army, and also, I'm afraid, dogs, to make sure that all the vehicles not carrying drugs or something like this.
Right, okay.
Yes. But one of the incidents we had is that we got like T-shirts, a green T-shirts, and the roads of the convoy was written on it. So we got like a map on the back of the T-shirts.
Yeah.
Partly between Algeria and Morocco, there was unconcrete agreement between those two countries on a small land, and that land was given to Algerian people on our T-shirts. So the Moroccan people decided to take off all the T-shirts from our bodies to their bags,
Yeah, they took the T-shirts.
Yes,
from you.
Yes.
So who took the T-shirts from you? How? What was the circumstance?
The escorts. We were at the seaport of Tanja. So we had to take off our T-shirts in the port in front of everybody to give it to them, because they were not happy with the decision that we made, or the manufacturer of the T-shirts have made.
So you had to sort of strip off at gunpoint, basically.
Yes. And even the women with us, they had to go back to their vans and close the door, take off the T-shirts, and put another T-shirt on them, and, hand it over to the T-shirt, to the green T-shirts, to the Moroccan government.
Just because of the little map on the back of the T-shirt?
Yes.
Okay. Perhaps an overreaction?
No. We did not react. We just want that mission to be met.
Okay, right, okay. Of all the countries in the Arabic countries, who were the least friendly and the most friendly? What was the sort of...
The least friendly one was Tunisia.
Okay.
This is my,
What is their political sort of stance, if any, on sort of Israel situation?
They wanted us to drive nighttime rather than the daytime. So we don't have a chance to be seen by people.
Right.
Or interact with people, or, engaged with them.
Is that because they fear that people would react in a strong way to you?
I don't know. That wasn't, clear to us. We had the same, political issue with Algeria and Morocco and Egypt, but we did not have this in Libya. Apparently, within, Moroccan land, we were kept about one day in a small village. We don't even have a reception on our mobile phones. And we were not allowed to leave that small village.
What was the reason?
We don't know. We don't know at all. We can't even raise our questions to them. The escort were all around the camp. We can't just ask.
So, Did you fear, you know, how long are we going to be here? Are we going to be here indefinitely?
No, basically, we left that to the high management people to deal with them.
Right.
But we were not allowed to even talk to them because we don't want them to stop us from crossing the border to Algeria.
Okay.
Because we were waiting for the next point to be open to us, which is Algerian, Tunisia, Algerian and Moroccan border that was, you know, closed for over 15 years. And it was opened only for us to cross that border and again closed after a couple of hours from us leaving that border to Algeria.
So
we were a little bit worried whether those people would allow us to cross it or not.
Did you have that concern before you even set out? Did you know that you may not be able to get across?
Yes, we knew that. And plan B was to wait for the ship to come from Tripoli to Morocco and cross Tunisia, across Algeria and Tunisia from the seaside to Tripoli.
Okay.
That was plan B, but, you know, we did not go to that plan.
Okay, judging by the negative, the problems that you've come up against, did most people sort of accept that you were a charitable cause, or did some people think perhaps you were sort of a political, you were representing some kind of political?
In fact, we were sort of both. We supported Hamas, the elected government in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, we delivering the aids to the public of Palestine.
Yeah.
So we were sort of both, but you know, it depends about people and the way they perceived us. Right. So in terms of you know, our mission, it was quite clear that we are delivering this aid.
Yeah.
We were not to harm or to, you know, act and behave you know, action to anyone.
Mm.
We went just across all the lands to Gaza. That was our aim. But government were a little bit worried about us from us.
I understand that you were trying to avoid capital cities. Why? What is the reason for that?
Our aim was to get through all the capital cities, to get the public engaged with us.
Right.
And also to make them aware about the situation and what's going on in Gaza.
Okay,
and so what's make our convoy moved from London to Gaza by land.
Yeah.
This is like an awareness session to those people. We did not manage to do that. Apparently from in Libya, that was the only country that welcomed us to cross through the capital city.
Right. So how come that you didn't manage to get into any of the other capital cities?
We were directed by the, you know, escorts and the army of each particular Arabic countries went through. Within the EU, we were just left alone. We did whatever we want. But our, you know, management want us to go through the plan, which is only to Madrid. And we managed to do the press conference there.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from there, we had a plan to go to capital city of Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, all of them.
Okay.
And Egypt. But we were not allowed to go through the capital cities.
Okay. Did you have a sort of press conferences sort of set up in these cities, or were you trying to, or were you going to try and drum up some public enthusiasm once you arrived?
Yes, we had a press release, but you know, it was only done with the government, or with a particular people who they trust to allow them to get engaged with us. So we did not go to the floor. We did not go to the ground to speak with people and tell them about our story and hear from them. Although there were, you know, a few incidents that we had a chance to talk to the ordinary people on the streets, where we had a lady wearing her wedding, wedding ring, and she took it off from her hand to us to pass it to the Palestinian people. That was another incident, and was in Algeria, a young lad about 20 years old. He wants us to put him in the car boot sale.
Did you manage to pick up any followers en route who came with you?
We did not manage to, due to the government's needs, apart from Libya. From Libya, yes, we had people came with us. I'm talking by myself. I got my father and three uncles with me in my vehicle into Gaza from Libya.
Now, what happened in Tunisia? You lost two vehicles that were led by women. What happened?
Those two vehicles, they got lost from just before the Algerian-Tunisian border. They crossed in Tunisia before us. And within Tunisian lands, because they crossed before us, they were taken by the escort straight away from the Algerian border to the Libyan border with no option of where to go.
Okay.
They took them straight away from the border to the other border, and they just throw them to the Libyan border. Right. When they crossed there, we heard about that.
Yeah.
We heard about them crossing to the Libyan border. But they were not allowed to cross to Libya because they had to have a visa.
Ah, okay, right.
And the visa we had is a collective visa, collective type of visa. So the whole convoy should cross together. Otherwise, okay. No one is going to be allowed to cross.
Okay.
In this incident, I was asked to contact the people to arrange the visa for them. So we contacted the hosted organization in Libya, which is the Gaddafi Foundation. That's been run by the son of Gaddafi. He's the chairman of that organization. He managed to get those people under his supervision.
So it was resolved
Libya.
In the end.
The result was they were safe and secure in Libya until we arrived there.
Okay, well, for this week, that's all we've got time for, Mohammed. Thank you very much for coming in. And now time for a song from our regular musician, Rachel Edmondson. And this is a song called In Lakesh.
When the drop of water tried to separate from sea, the soil is running from the earth, the leaf is angry with the tree. When the wind, he cannot stand the thought of speaking to the air and the flame, he feels he does not have a place in the fire. Snowflake cannot comprehend why blanket on the ground, and the grain of sand wonders how this beach came that he sat on. Many separate himself from all that he can see. In Lakesh, I am you and you are me. When the letter cannot see, change the meaning of the word, and the note understand his place in the chord, and the tongue thinks he is of no use to the mouth. In Lakesh, I am another yourself. Stroke of paint don't understand why he's in the picture, and the sun don't see his role in the dawn, cause if he leaves it then he thinks he won't be missed, like the spirit proved his science that he didn't exist. Don't prove yourself wrong. Don't prove yourself wrong. Don't prove yourself wrong. When the drop of water tried to separate from sea, the soil is running from the earth, the leaf is angry with the tree. When the wind, he cannot stand the thought of speaking to the air, and the flame, he feels he does not have a place in the fire. Snowflake cannot comprehend white blanket on the ground, the grain of sand wonders how this beach came that he sat on, and the man, he separate himself from all that he can see. Kesh in Lakesh, I am you and you are me. When the letter cannot see, change the meaning of the word, and the note understand his place in the chord, and the tongue thinks he is of no use to the mouth. In Lakesh, I am another yourself. Stroke of paint don't understand why he's in the picture, and the sun don't see his role in the dawn, cause if he leaves it then he thinks he won't be missed, like the spirit proved with science that he didn't exist. Don't prove yourself wrong. Don't prove yourself wrong. Don't prove yourself wrong. Don't prove yourself wrong.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
It's time now for another instalment of The History of the Mafia, read by Malcolm Greaves.
The History of Organised Crime by David Southwell. In the last two decades, Europe has undergone the type of radical political and economic transformation that many predicted would take a century of history to bring about. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, the continent is often seen as a land without many of the old borders. One European market, one European people. The drive to ever closer integration seems for many to be an inexorable process. The new Europe is increasingly viewed as one territory not just by politicians, but also by Europe's numerous organised crime gangs. For years, criminals have dreamt of bigger markets, fewer barriers to trade and free movement of people and goods. It was not just the forces of democracy that were unleashed by the crumbling of the Soviet state. From the ashes of the Eastern Bloc came a host of organised criminal groups looking to expand into rich Western European markets. Without the Warsaw Pact, it was only a matter of time before the museum of conflicts in the Balkans erupted into bloody fighting. One result of those wars has been new criminal empires emerging from countries such as Serbia and Albania. Established organised crime groups such as the Corsican Mafia may have seen a decline in recent years, but for newer players in gangland Europe, the last decade has been a time of unprecedented boom. The Albanian Mafia has been one group to have grown considerably since the fall of communism in its homeland in 1991. As the statues of Marx and the Albanian communist dictator Enver Hoxha were pulled down, law and order began to collapse in the north of Albania, an area that had always been regarded as bandit country. The political chaos of a country trying to emerge into democracy finally loosed the restraining bonds on the local criminal clan chiefs, and northern Albania quickly became a virtually autonomous and lawless region. These were already perfect conditions for the emergence of a new criminal network, but added to this in 1991 was the outbreak of war in neighbouring Yugoslavia. The war disrupted one of the major pathways for heroin entering Western Europe. Italian and Sicilian mafia groups seeking alternative routes seized on the opportunity presented by an increasingly unregulated Albania. Alliances with the 15 Families, a grouping of Albanian criminal clans operating out of the north of the country who had been dabbling in drug trafficking since the 1970s, were forged. Within months, the Italian mafia had a huge presence in Albania, especially the port city of Vlorë. The Albanians quickly learned from their Italian colleagues, adopting the traditional mafia organisational structure. And within a couple of years, they were no longer happy being the junior partners in the heroin trafficking operation. The 15 Families expanded, forcibly assimilating criminal groups in other areas of Albania, and emerging as the force in organised crime that was quickly dubbed the Albanian Mafia by European police officers. After asserting their position over their former Italian allies, the Albanians were quick to expand their role in heroin distribution. By 1999, Interpol estimated that the Mafia controlled 60% of the European heroin trade. With the aim of extending the zone of lawlessness in which their criminal empire flourished, the Albanian Mafia began to heavily fund armed secessionist movements for the Albanian communities in the neighbouring countries of Kosovo and Macedonia, including the Kosovo Liberation Army. The full-scale war they helped foment in Kosovo in the late 1990s was incredibly good for business. New fortunes were being made, smuggling thousands of fleeing refugees. And with a flood of armaments in the region, the Mafia became a major player in arms dealing. When the United Nations took political and military control of Kosovo in June 1999, the Albanian Mafia became their effective partner in running the country. Corruption amongst UN personnel and the military in the NATO-led Kosovo force was so endemic at one point that NATO vehicles were used for smuggling, and UN administrators colluded in the trafficking of women and children. A Kanun clan law of Albania sees women and children as property that can be bought and sold. This partially explains the massive part the Albanian Mafia now plays in prostitution across Europe, especially in Great Britain, where they control vice networks in most parts of the country. A young girl bought for a few hundred pounds in Albania can be smuggled into the UK and sold to a new owner for at least £5,000. She will be expected to generate an income through forced prostitution of at least £30,000 per year. A strong alliance for the trafficking of women and prostitution rackets is in operation in Italy, Austria, Germany and Switzerland, and has grown between Italian mafia grouping the Sacra Corona Unita and the Albanian Mafia. Other Italian mafia groups have allowed the Albanians to run the prostitution, hash and people smuggling operations on their territory in return for collecting a tax on the illicit trades, and the understanding that the Mafia will not expand into any other areas on Italian soil. Through Albanian refugee and emigre communities, the Mafia has established operations not only across Europe, but in America too. Recent bloody conflicts with the Turkish and Kurdish gangs, especially in Germany for control of the heroin trade, has increased international police attention on the mafia. Neither shootings, mass arrests, nor the imprisonment of 15 family boss Daut Kadriovski has been able to slow the Albanian mafia's rise to ever-increasing underworld power. The Albanian mafia were not the only organised crime network to thrive on the wars that were unleashed by the fall of communist rule. As 1,000 years of bottled ethnic, religious and political prejudice exploded across the map of Yugoslavia in 1991, Serbian organised criminals began a rise to power that not only saw them enter the gangland of Europe as a significant new player, but also to finance war crimes and assassinate a prime minister. During the days of Tito's communist rule over Yugoslavia, not only were the tensions that would later destroy the Federation of States kept in check, organised criminal activity was heavily policed. Despite this, smuggling groups operated on the Croatian coast and on the unruly borders between Kosovo and Albania, while the most powerful organised crime gangs operated out of the capital, Belgrade. The backbone of the Nasa Štvar, one of the names given to the Serbian mafia, were the five major gangs operating in Belgrade, each taking its name from the district in the city in which it was based. Of these, the Vojdovac and the Zemun gangs were regarded as the most powerful, with interests in prostitution, smuggling and blackmail. The business, as some gang members referred to it, managed to survive under Tito due to heavy police corruption and its ability to meet the needs of the populace that the state could not. However, with the disintegration of the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia in 1991 and the subsequent wars between the various states that had once been a part of it, the brakes were taken off the Serbian mafia just at the time when myriad opportunities to profit from the misery of armed conflict were arising. The imposition of harsh economic and trade sanctions on Serbia also created massive profits for those who had already established smuggling networks. Various elements of the Serbian mafia poured a portion of their massive illicit profits into forming paramilitary units that were meant to protect Serbs in areas outside the Republic of Serbia. However, in reality, these Serb volunteer units became an unofficial part of the Serbian war machine and were implicated in some of the worst war crimes of the Yugoslav Wars. The paramilitary forces welded the Nasa Štvar to the highest ranks of Serbian government. It was often difficult to work out where the regime of President Slobodan Milosevic ended, and the business began. One of the most notable figures that blended this role of leading the Tigers, a paramilitary group that had started with the 20 Red Star Belgrade soccer club supporters and became a force of 10,000 men, was Jeliko Raznatovic, more commonly known as Arkan, a name he gave himself after a character in the comic The Avengers. The career criminal was intent on maintaining his political and underworld power in peacetime. Arkan's death was just one of the many high-profile killings as the Vojdovac and Zemun gangs openly operated death squads on the streets of Belgrade. They made it clear they had no intention of giving up any of the power they had acquired during the war years. The killing of Police Chief Major General Bosco Buha in 2002, just days after he announced he would clamp down on organised crime, was a clear show of the true power of the Serbian mafia. However, with the killing of Prime Minister Zoran Dindic in 2003, their utter contempt for the official leaders of Serbia backfired. A massive crackdown followed his assassination, with more than 300 suspected Serbian mafia members arrested, including Ceca Rajnatovic. She was held in custody for 4 months on charges of illegal weapon possession and harbouring wanted felons before being released without being convicted. Despite the high-profile action that has been taken against organised crime post-Dindic's death, the Serbian mafia is so entrenched in the Serbian economy and politics that its influence makes it appear almost a vast shadow government. Alongside billions of dollars already laundered in the West, interests in cigarette smuggling, arms dealing, people trafficking, cybercrime and extortion now extend its reach across all of Europe. Unfortunately, the fall of Yugoslavia will not be the last time war and the bloody politics of power help to spread the blight of organised crime.
That was Malcolm Greaves reading an instalment from The History of the Mafia. This is a song from Dario Gerci, recorded at the Halo Cafe at the open mic night in Bristol. It's the Italian version of a song called A Night in White Satin.
Notte di luce, la notte infinita.
Dario Gerci singing the Italian version of Nights in White Satin, recorded at the Halo Cafe. Our intrepid reporter, Anthony Page, has been travelling around South America. This week is the last interview from the recent trip. It features the town of Pisco, hit by an earthquake on the 15th of August 2007. Since then, despite being handed a massive amount of money by foreign countries, the government of Peru hasn't done anything to help the town. The site where the main church stood is a flattened piece of ground. The floors of the bank hang derelicts, the roads are still a mess, and where the houses stood lie barren earth and brick walls. The citizens, desperate to get work underway to rebuild the town, but the government chooses to ignore them. This is an interview with Giovanni Moretti, a tour guide and ex-army officer who helped dig out the victims.
Giovanni Moretti, I'm a tour guide in Pisco. Pisco is near from Lima, 3 hours from Lima. I was here during the night of August the 15th, 2007, during the earthquake. It was at 6:40 p.m. It was a very long earthquake, almost 3 minutes, and the grade was 8.4.
Were there two?
There were two, but almost together, okay. At the same time.
What happened at the first quake?
Was, like I told you, in horizontal way. People didn't pay too much attention because they were afraid always to the ocean, to the sea, about tsunamis, but not earthquakes.
Oh, I see.
That's the reason. In the second movement, people start trying to getting out. But the problem is in Pisco, the houses are very old, made from adobe. Adobe is clay with sand. They didn't have any piece of iron, even columns.
So it all crashed?
They collapsed at all.
What happened to the church?
The church was the same, from adobe, it collapsed. The church had two columns, and they collapsed like this.
Was there anyone inside?
Yes, and the church were died more than almost 200 people, 180 or 200, during the night.
Did you help people climb from the rubble?
Yeah, I was helping people that night in the hospital and rescuing in the church, many places during the night. It was dark. Flashlights,
no electricity.
No electricity. We didn't have tools. No, we were all night until the firemen came next day at 9 a.m. from Lima, 8:30, 9 a.m. they start coming from Lima. And soldiers too from the army, they start coming. But during the night, it was very terrible. Maybe for one month. But after that, people in Pisco didn't want to. The economy was low.
Affected everything. The economy.
We didn't have tourist business for almost 2 months. After that, we start coming. Tourists start coming, but little by little.
But what about the local people? Are they still living in temporary accommodation?
Some of them. They live in tents, or they have
Prefabricated.
Yeah, prefabricated. But some people don't have any house like this, because the government doesn't want to help to all the people. No?
But they got a lot of foreign aid.
Yeah, yes, from all the world, from Spain too.
Have they used that to help the people?
Some of them they have, but not all. It's 1 year and a half after the earthquake. Not many houses, many people are still living in tents or in very small houses. So there is a lot of dust in the streets. The roads are broken.
Do you think the government will help you eventually, help the people in the tents or not?
Yes, they help it, but not too much, not like we hope, you know?
Are the people getting angry about this?
Yes, very young. Last night there was a meeting, 6 p.m. We were complaining to the mayor.
About the lack of...
To the mayor, for the...
Building work.
Yeah, to play factory houses, to help people.
Do you know anything about the Orion radio?
Radio station.
Yeah.
Yeah, the man, he's local news. He was telling that the grade of the earthquake was 8.4, and the weatherman said no, it was 7.9, because he didn't pay to help the people, no? The army took the radio station, yeah.
Yeah, and he was put in prison.
Yeah, the local journalist was in prison, was one of the owners too, was in prison for 10 days, I think. And they took all the equipment out of the radio station to the police station. Yeah, they closed on the radio for 1 month.
So what about the future? Any hope?
Yeah, I know people are... That's the reason last night there was a meeting for complaining to the mayor, you know, to help.
How many people are living in tents?
Right now, there may be... Well, less, no? Families, maybe.
How many?
50, well, no more than 100.
100 families?
In all town. Pisco is the capital, there are many districts around.
Do the poor families who are living in the tents, do they get food from the government?
No. But they got for almost 6 months. A lot of canned fish, fruits, candies, water, medicine. Also the Cubans, there is a special doctor from Cuba, they have a hospital. They are volunteers. From Cuba, there is a group of doctors. They are volunteers too. They have a camp in San Clemente, in La Villa, Tupac Amaru, in the Pan American Road. They help people with medicine, with attention. They can help since the earthquake, 1 year and a half.
So what can people from other countries do to help the families that are still in tents?
They help with some of them. They make the terrace, the floor. No?
The floor?
We call the floor, the cement, the basement for the prefactory houses. Now the volunteers help make.
When do the families get a house?
Yeah, but the tents are special tents, thermal tents. The problem is because they want prefabricated house. Some of them, many of them, they are big families. They have living in one. This is small. No, it has to be maybe two or a little bigger. Prefabricated house don't have bathroom. No? They have to make another bathroom behind the house.
why is it taking the government so long? Why haven't they sorted it?
Well, the way they things happen in South America.
Well, nobody does anything.
You know, Spain have make a donation, big donation for more than 60,000 euros, maybe 6 million euros, I can't remember. Also for the museum, 1 million and 500,000 euros.
For the Inca Museum?
For the Inca Museum in Paracas.
Yeah.
But the government doesn't move any stone here.
Where's all the money gone?
In Lima. The money's in Lima, in the main office in Lima. They should have sent the money to his place, to the mayor, to the bus in Ica, no, the National Institute of Culture, or they should have come to manage the construction. And the museum is small. It didn't have too much damage during the earthquake, but they have to make a new building, a new modern and bigger one with restaurant, a small cafeteria. They have sent the money.
Is there anything that people in Britain can do? And can they write to your president?
Yeah.
Send a letter to your president?
Yeah. And they say, oh, yeah, later. We're going to next week, 2 more weeks. Yeah.
Nothing?
Never say that. And many poor people, and the economy is no good in Pisco. Pisco is a port, all port. No, tourists move there. Maybe 30% of the economy of this town. There are other industries, fish meal factories, the natural gas plant, smelter, but it's not like the economy is slow. Some people drink too much sometimes, so drink beer, fishermen.
That was an interview in Pisco in Peru, hit by an earthquake on the 15th of August 2007.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
This is another instalment from the Princess Diana interview. It's a clip from the Panorama programme where Martin Bashir interviewed the great lady herself. This week, part 5, 1992, that's around the time we're looking at. a transcript of a phone conversation between Diana and James Gilbey was published.
What was your reaction when news broke of allegedly a telephone conversation between you and Mr. James Gilbey having been recorded?
I felt very protective about James because he'd been a very good friend to me and was a very good friend to me, and I couldn't bear that his life was going to be messed up because he had the connection with me. And that worried me. I'm very protective about my friends.
Did you have the alleged telephone conversation?
Yes, we did. Absolutely we did. Yeah, we did.
On that tape, Mr. Gilbey expresses his affection for you. Was that transcript accurate?
Yes. I mean, he is a very affectionate person. But the implications of that conversation were that we'd had an adulterous relationship, which was not true.
Have you any idea how that conversation came to be published in the national press?
No, but it was done to harm me in a serious manner, and that was the first time I'd experienced what it was like to be outside the net, so to speak, and not be in the family.
What do you think the purpose was behind it?
It was to make the public change their attitude towards me. It was... You know, if we are going to divorce, my husband would hold more cards than I would. It was a very much a poker game, chess game.
There were also a series of telephone calls which allegedly were made by you to a Mr. Oliver Hoare. Did you make what were described as nuisance phone calls?
I was reputed to have made 300 telephone calls in a very short space of time, which... bearing my lifestyle at that time, made me a very busy lady. no, I didn't, but that again was a huge move to discredit me, and very nearly did me in, the injustice of it, because I did my own homework on that subject and consequently found out that a young boy had done most of them. But I read that I'd done them all. Mr. Hoare told me that his lines were being tapped by the local police station. He said, you know, don't ring. So I didn't, but somebody clearly did.
Had you made any of those calls at all?
I used to, yes, I had rung up, yes.
Once, twice, three times?
I don't know, but it was a period of 6 to 9 months. A few times, but certainly not an obsessive manner, no.
Do you really believe that a campaign was being waged against you?
Yes, I did, absolutely, yeah.
Why?
I was a separated wife of the Prince of Wales. I was a problem, full stop, never happened before. What do we do with her?
Can't we pack her off to somewhere quietly rather than campaign against her?
She won't go quietly, that's the problem. I'll fight till the end, because I believe that I have a role to fulfil. And I got two children to bring up.
By the end of 1993, you had suffered persistent difficulties with the press. These phone conversations were made public. And you decided to withdraw from public life.
Yeah.
Why did you do that?
The pressure was intolerable then, and my job was, my work was being affected. I wanted to give 110% to my work, and I could only give 50. I was constantly tired, exhausted, because the pressure was just, it was so cruel. So I thought the only way to do it was to stand up and make a speech and extract myself before I started disappointing and not carrying out my work. It was my decision to make that speech because I owed it to the public to say that, you know, thank you. I'm disappearing for a bit, but I'll come back.
It wasn't very long before you did come back, of course.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I did a lot of work, what I call underground, without any media attention, so I never really stopped doing it. I just didn't do it every day, out and about. I just couldn't do it. You know, the campaign was, in that point, was being successful. But it did surprise the people who were causing the grief. It did surprise them when I took myself out of the game. They hadn't expected that. And I'm a great believer that you should always confuse the enemy.
Who was the enemy?
Well, the enemy was my husband's department because I always got more publicity. My work was discussed much more than him. And, you know, from that point of view, I understand it. But I was doing good things, and I wanted to do good things. I was never going to hurt anyone. I was never going to let anyone down.
But you really believe that it was out of jealousy that they wanted to undermine you?
I think it was out of fear, because here was a strong woman doing her bit. And where was she getting her strength from to continue?
What was your reaction to your husband's disclosure to Jonathan Dimbleby that he had, in fact, committed adultery?
Well, I was totally unaware of the content of the book, and actually saw it on the news that night that it would come out. And my first concern was to the children, because they were able to understand what was coming out, and I wanted to protect them. But I was pretty devastated myself. But then I admired the honesty, because it takes a lot to do that.
In what sense?
Well, to be honest about a relationship with someone else in his position is quite something.
How did you handle this with the children?
I went to the school and put it to William, particularly, that if you find someone you love in life, you must hang on to it and look after it. And you were very lucky to find if you were lucky enough to find someone who loved you, then one must protect it. William asked me what had been going on, and could I answer his questions, of which I did. He said, was that the reason why our marriage broken up? And I said, well, there were three of us in this marriage, and the pressure of the media was another factor. So the two together were very difficult. But although I still love Papa, I couldn't live under the same roof as him, and likewise with him.
What effect do you think it had on Prince William?
Well, he's a child that's a deep thinker. And we won't know for a few years how it's gone in. But I put it in gently, without resentment or any anger.
Looking back now, do you feel at all responsible for the difficulties in your marriage?
I take full responsibility. I take some responsibility that our marriage went the way it did. I'll take half of it, but I won't take any more than that, because it takes two to get in this situation.
But you do bear some of the responsibility.
Absolutely. We both made mistakes.
Another book that was published recently concerned a Mr. James Hewitt, in which he claimed to have had a very close relationship with you from about 1989, I think. What was the nature of your relationship?
He was a great friend of mine at a very difficult time, yet another difficult time, and he was always there to support me. And I was absolutely devastated when this book appeared, because I trusted him. And because, again, I worried about the reaction of my children. And yes, there was factual evidence in the book, but a lot of it comes from another world. Didn't equate to what happened.
What do you mean?
Well, there was a lot of fantasy in that book. And it was very distressing for me that a friend of mine, who I had trusted, made money out of me. I really minded about that. And he'd rung me up 10 days before it arrived in the bookshops to tell me that there was nothing to worry about. And I believed him stupidly. And then when it did arrive, the first thing I did was rush down to talk to my children. And William produced a box of chocolates and said, "Mummy, I think you've been hurt. These are to make you smile again." So...
Did your relationship go beyond a close friendship?
Yes, it did. Yes.
Were you unfaithful?
Yes, I adored him. Yes, I was in love with him. But I was very let down.
That was part five of our 7-part clipping of the Panorama interview where Martin Bashir interviewed Princess Diana. Next week, part six, 1995, Princess Diana now lives alone at Kensington Palace and her hopes for William and Harry.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
He needs no introduction. Here is Jess Barks.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is a What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday, 3rd of April, and at the Croft in Bristol, The Exiles, The Colliding Lemons, Civics, The Echoes, Mathematics, Concepts of Inebriation and Wild Galoots will all be performing in the Surface Unsigned Festival Round 1. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £6 in advance. Also on 3rd of April, and at the Polish Club in Bristol, The Bolsheviks will be performing with support from Kiel Van Helsing, plus there will be a burlesque show. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £6 in advance. Moving on to Song of the Week, and this group have been branded as heavy metal, but both themselves and the fans know them as rock and roll. I am of course on about Motorhead, and this track is titled Rock and Roll from the album of the same name.
I got
That was Motorhead with the track Rock and Roll from the album of the same name. They have recently been announced as Friday main stage headliners for this year's Girlfest. The other headliners are Brian Wilson on the Saturday and Happy Mondays on the Sunday. Moving on to 4th of April and at the Bocca Bar, which is at Paintworks in Bristol, Dr. Meeker will be performing with support from Kid Carpet. Doors open at 7pm and tickets are £6 in advance and £8 on the door. Also on 4th of April and at the Elm Tree, which is at Queen's Road in Bishopsworth, Bristol, the Mangled Wurzels will be performing. The gig starts around 9pm and entry is free. Finally, on 5th of April and at the Carnation Tap in Bristol, James Morton and the Lunatics will be performing. The gig starts at 4pm and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
That's the end of this week's Dalek Radio Show from the Bristol Radio Co-op, based in the city centre. Today's studio guest was Mohammed El Haddad, talking about the recent convoy to the Gaza Strip that was organised by the UK Arabic Society and Viva Palestina. And of course he'll be coming back next week to continue chatting about it, so we look forward to hearing from him. If you want to help the people of Gaza, you can buy goods direct, fairly traded olive and produce from Palestine at www.zaytoun.org. And Zaytoun is spelt Z-A-Y-T-O-U-N. Our guest musician was Rachel Evanson. More from her next week. Malcolm Grieve read another instalment of The History of the Mafia, and Tony Gosling brought us the clip from Panorama, the Diana interview. Anthony Page interviewed Giovanni Moretti and Pisco near Lima in Peru, and the What's On was presented by Jeff Sparks. Phyllis Church-Curran was the studio engineer, and this week's show was produced by Anthea Page. You can download the show on the internet at www.dialectradio.co.uk. You can email us on Bristol Radio Co-op, that's all one word, at hotmail.co.uk. So it's goodbye from all of us here at Dialect Radio. And take care of yourselves. Until next week, goodbye.